It is great to be with you this morning. It's great to see familiar faces and new faces. We have been in France now for 8 years. Hi, Charlotte. It's okay. And it's great to be back with you. Marblehead, we consider our home church, and we are happy to be here, happy to be present with you guys, and happy afterwards that we get to talk more about what we do in France at the Stedman's house. So if you want to come and hear more about what we do, please come. Come with your hard questions. Easy questions too, but hard questions as well. And we would delight in getting to talk more with you about what we do in France. This passage is an especially dear one to me as someone who is in ministry, someone who is in cross-cultural ministry, to remember that it is God's grace, God's glory that is at work, even though I am weak, even though we are all weak. So let's dive into the text together today. Paul had a complicated relationship with the Corinthian church. If you've ever read 1 and 2 Corinthians, you can see there's something going on. There's always problems with the Corinthian church. In 1 Corinthians, it's division. So the church is divided on everything. It seems like spiritual gifts. It seems like there are people suing one another. It seems like some people prefer Peter. Some people prefer Apollos. Some people prefer Paul. And there's 1,000 different schisms for a church that's not 1,000 people strong, but a handful of people, probably over a couple of households. And so Paul writes 1 Corinthians to bring unity in the gospel, to bring this church together. But it seems like in 2 Corinthians, they've united, and they've united around one thing. They don't think that Paul is a very good apostle. They do not think that he is worth following. It seems like these other apostles, these other ministers, these other leaders have come in and kind of given the Corinthians a low opinion of Paul. Paul kind of refers to them later on in 2 Corinthians as super apostles. And so these people, it seems like they spoke well. They were trained in rhetoric, which Paul may have been, he may not have been, but it seems like they spoke well and Paul didn't, at least in their opinion. They talked about their spiritual experiences, their visions, the miracles, all this stuff that happened. Paul downplayed that kind of stuff, didn't really seem to talk about it too much. They took money from the Corinthians, which we would think is odd, but the Corinthians kind of liked the fact that they could pay for the services that they were receiving, and Paul wouldn't take any money. So in every way, these people seem superior to Paul, at least in the Corinthians' eyes. And so Paul is writing this letter not because he's jealous, not because he's trying to regain authority over the church, not because he wants the church back on his side, but because he knows that if they follow these super apostles, there's a danger that they'll miss the whole thing. They'll miss what the gospel is all about. The super apostles are all about the extraordinary, the wonderful, the marvelous. But Paul is here to say, no, if you preach the gospel, you live a life shaped by the gospel. The message and the lifestyle go together. Preaching about the cross means you live a life shaped by the cross. And so Paul is here to say, it may seem backwards to us, it may seem upside down, but God is actually putting the world right. God is making things the way that they're supposed to be. So how? What in the world does this mean? In the first couple of verses, he talks about treasure in jars of clay, which shows us that appearances aren't always what they seem. So in chapter 3 and 4, he's been talking about this new covenant, this new thing that God is doing in Jesus. And he's comparing it with the Old Testament. He's comparing it with Moses. So with Moses, God came down on Sinai. He gave the law. Moses would come down, come out of seeing God, and his face would be glowing, and the people would be impressed by what God has done through Moses. But what Paul says is what God has done in Christ is even better than that. It's even better than coming and bringing the law. God has actually come down in person, in Christ, died for us, given his life for us, so that through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, something greater has taken place than even what happened with Moses. So Jesus brings us close to God. Jesus brings us into a relationship with God. Moses brought us the law, which brought death and condemnation, but Jesus brings grace. He brings healing. He brings truth. He brings who God is close to us. So what's happened in this new covenant is way better than what happened with Moses. Even though what happened with Moses was good, it was good what happened in the Old Testament. It wasn't a bad thing. It's not like God changed his mind and changed direction. Something good happened and something far better has taken place in Christ. In Jesus, we don't just have a religion. We have a relationship with God through him. And so because of Christ, we can be like sons and daughters coming to their Father who loves them. And so Jesus has done something way better than what Moses did. So life, even reality itself, is different because Jesus has risen from the dead. But what's strange is, it doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like anything has changed. It seems like everything is going on exactly how it always has been. And even for Paul, it seems like life has gotten worse. Once he was called by God, things went from bad to worse to worse. If you read Acts, Paul's call is to suffer. And Paul's saying, that's exactly the point. If my life looks like one continuous parade of suffering, that's exactly right. That's what it should look like. He talks about how he's afflicted, perplexed, persecuted, struck down. But in all this, and this is what's strange, he's afflicted but not crushed, perplexed but not driven to despair, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed. He carries around this treasure of the gospel, this treasure worth giving your life for, inside of him. There's something going on inside of Paul that, contrary to Moses, whose face shone, Paul looks like a pot. Paul looks like just a dirty vessel that you would use for anything. Nothing special, nothing extraordinary. But what's happening is taking place inside of him. What the gospel is doing its work inside of him. So the super apostles were holding out the gospel as some kind of free pass, some kind of life that just keeps getting better and better. But Paul's saying, no, if you really believe this, if you really believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead, you're on the same path that he is, which is one difficult thing after another until death. Sounds encouraging, doesn't it? But Jesus died so that we might live. And Paul's saying, as an apostle, that's the same thing that I'm doing. I'm dying so that you might live. You, Corinthians, get to live off of my death. And so we are called to do the same thing. And following Jesus, if you're a follower of Jesus, you are called to lay down your life so that other people around you can live. And it doesn't have to be dramatic. This could be giving time to someone who doesn't seem grateful for it, praying for a family member or a friend when it doesn't seem like things are getting any better, giving away money that you worked hard for, telling the truth even when everyone else is lying, suffering illness, unemployment, loss, and a million other deaths with confidence that only God can bring something out of this. There's nothing that we can do. There needs to be some kind of resurrection, some kind of change that only God can do. It looks upside down to us, but it's God's way of working, and he's making the world right. So why? For what purpose? Why do this? Paul says, because ministry is dying so that others might live, all that God gets the glory. Not us, but God. And so he goes into verses 13 through 15, and he quotes from Psalm 116. He says, since we have the same spirit of faith according to what has been written, I believed and so I spoke. And so, like I said, this is Psalm 116. I want to read you a little bit from this psalm just to kind of get a flavor of what this is like. And so it starts, I love the Lord because he heard my voice and my pleas for mercy. The snares of death encompassed me. I suffered distress and great anguish. Then I called on the name of the Lord. Gracious is the Lord and righteous. Our God is merciful, for you have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. So then comes the quote in verse 10, which Paul gives, I believe and so I spoke. And so the psalm goes on to say, what shall I render to the Lord for all of his benefits to me? I will lift up the cup of salvation and call on the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows to the Lord in the presence of all his people. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. O Lord, I am your servant. I am your servant, the son of your maidservant. You have loosed my bonds. I will offer to you the sacrifice of thanksgiving and call on the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows to the Lord in the presence of all his people. Paul shares the same faith of the psalmist, that God hasn't abandoned him in his suffering, that hardships of those who trust in God are seen, are noticed, are of deep importance, that God cares, that God rescues, that God saves. And what do you do when you've experienced this salvation? What do you do when God has done something great for you? You tell other people about it. You announce it. You make vows. You offer sacrifices. You lift up the cup of salvation. So for Paul, that's making Christ known. That's reminding the Corinthians of Jesus' death and resurrection for them. So, like I said, we've been in France now for 8 years, and I have, I would say, a little bit of wisdom to pass on. And so when new missionaries come, I spend some time with them trying to orient them to France and ministry and that kind of thing. And one of the things I tell them, which is pretty soon after they get off the plane, is, you didn't know it, but you came here to die. I like to, you know, build them up right when they get there so they're ready. You know, people know when you're moving to a different country or different culture that you have to give up your family, you have to give up your friends, you have to give up certain things. But what you don't reckon with is how weak you become in this new culture. You don't speak the language. You don't understand why people do what they do. You feel inept. You feel stupid. I was afraid to answer the phone because you have no idea what the other person is saying. You don't know if you're getting scammed. You don't know if this is paying bills. You don't know what they want. I would sweat profusely. I'd have to wipe the phone off halfway through because I couldn't. It gets better, but you realize you came to tell people about Jesus and you're afraid to open your mouth because you don't want to look like a fool. You have to die. You have to lay down your life. You have to lay down your sense of self so that someone else can live, so that someone else can hear about Jesus, so that someone else can hear the gospel. All so that God gets the glory. We look like fools, and God is held up. It's so that he can work through our weakness. So the life of an apostle or a follower of Jesus is full of all kinds of suffering, humiliation, death, and difficulty. So why do it? Why put yourself through all this? It sounds pretty bad. And Paul understands that that's where we would go. And so at the end, in verses 16 through 18, he lays out the fact that our future glory isn't even worth comparing with our present suffering. In the same way that Jesus' life and death would seem like a complete waste without the resurrection, Paul is saying, as Christians, that's exactly what we're hoping into. And our resurrection is guaranteed by Jesus' resurrection. It would all be for nothing if God didn't intervene, if God didn't do something. God's way of doing things may seem upside down to us. Life through death, salvation through suffering, glory through shame. But God is immensely good. And what he has in store for us blows every bit of that out of the water. You see, we may be like jars of clay, kind of roughly treated, rattling around, chipped and broken, but the treasure of the gospel is doing something inside of us. And there's an image that I love that I think captures this really, really well. I don't know if you guys have ever heard, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's this Japanese art form called kintsugi. And so what happens is, in Japan, tea sets are incredibly valuable, and they're passed down through generations. And so cups and pitchers and all those kinds of things for making tea get broken over the course of generation. They get chipped. They get shattered. And what happens is, after a while, someone will take them to what's called a kintsugi master. And this person takes these pots, takes these cups, and puts them back together, but puts them back together using gold in the cracks. And so what eventually happens is the teapot becomes more valuable than what it was before it was broken. It looks more beautiful than what it was before it was broken. And God is like the ultimate kintsugi master who takes us, these broken pots, and fixes us so that at the resurrection, this treasure that's inside of us will burst forth, will show out that the gospel has done its work, that he makes us more beautiful than we would be if we wouldn't have experienced the suffering and the cracks and those things. What Paul says is that God is preparing this eternal weight of glory. Once again, like Moses, we're soaking up the glory of God so that we can reflect it for all eternity. I don't know about you, but the word glory for me is hard to get my head around. It sounds you know, it sounds like a Christian-y word. It sounds like a spiritual word. It sounds like a word that doesn't have a whole lot of depth to it. You know, it's kind of airy. It's kind of mystical. It's kind of strange. But in the Old Testament, the glory of God was the exact opposite. When God showed up, everything got heavier. It got more real. God was brighter than the sun. You know, when God came into the temple in the Old Testament, when they built the temple, it says that the priests had to go out of the temple because the glory of God filled the temple. So it's kind of like the reality behind everything has shown up, and we can't stand in its presence. So for Paul, what he's saying is this glory that God is doing, this thing that he's making, is making us more real, making us more sure, or making us more than what the suffering was. If we could put them in a scale, they couldn't compare. One couldn't compare with the other. And so what Paul is thinking of here is Jesus' resurrected body. Once again, I always had this idea that, you know, Jesus was kind of like a ghost when he rose from the dead. You know, he's disappearing, he's passing through walls, he's here, and then he's there. But what if it was the opposite? What if Jesus' body was the real thing, and everything around him was sort of inconsequential, smoke-like, misty in comparison? Jesus could pass through walls not because he was not solid and the walls were, but the other way around. What God is doing with us is making us more holy, more beautiful, more real than what we ever would be before. We may be wasting away day by day, but what God is doing in us, what he is producing, is this eternal weight of glory. We're being renewed day by day. Now, this process won't be finished until the age to come. Like I said, even now, it doesn't seem like that much is happening. It seems like things are going on the way they always ever have been. But there's an image that I really, really like from the Chronicles of Narnia, and my son perks up because we were reading the Chronicles of Narnia during one of the lockdowns. And so in the, I think it's the fifth book, is the fifth book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So if you guys have ever read it, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful book. I would recommend it just because it's great. But what's interesting is in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, they're on an ocean voyage. And so they're sailing to the east. They're sailing to the edge of Narnia. And what's different about Narnia than our world is Narnia isn't a globe. It's, as far as they know, it's flat. And so as they go east, they get this perception that the sun is starting to look bigger. And so one of the characters thinks at first, like, it's just seeming that way. It's kind of odd. But after a while, she starts to think, no, like, the sun is actually bigger than it was when we started out. And so they keep going further and further east, and eventually one of the characters falls into the water, and they realize that the water is not salt water anymore. It's sweet. And so they're all intrigued by this, and they actually start drinking the water. And it's kind of like the water's been soaking up the sun. The water is closer to the sun than it was, you know, further back, and the water is changing and being transformed. And so they call this water drinkable light. And everyone on the ship starts to drink the water, and they notice something as they drink. So since they have come this far east, there had been too much light. It had been really hard for them to stand in the sun. And it says this. It says, "The sun was too large, though not too hot. The sea too bright, the air too shining. Now the light grew no less. If anything, it increased. But they could bear it. They could look straight up at the sun without blinking. They could see more light than they had ever seen before. And the deck and the sail and their own faces and bodies became brighter and brighter, and every rope shone. The next morning when the sun rose, now 5 or 6 times its old size, they stared hard into it, and could see the very feathers of the birds that came flying from it. In drinking the light, they became like the light. They could bear the intensity of the enormous sun. They were being changed, little by little, to inhabit a world more beautiful, more wonderful, more astounding than they could ever imagine. God's ways may seem backwards to us, but as we look to Jesus, as we think about his death for us, as we contemplate this treasure of the gospel, even though we're wasting away, we're becoming something new and beautiful in Christ. The scars of our suffering may stay, just like the holes in the nails from the spear stayed in Jesus' side and hands and his resurrected body, but we'll see them for exactly what they were for him, the marks of God's undying, unquenchable, unchangeable, unconquerable love.